It's time for Gerby's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gerby. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan Gerby and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gerby and Carrie Kasem.
Hit it. good afternoon, everyone. I am Alan Gerby, and I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan Gerby and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Ms. Carrie Kasem.
Where's the applause? I don't hear it.
I can hear the applause. So as usual today, folks, we are here to turn negatives into positives. This is Gerby's Law, not Murphy's Law. Because, of course, Murphy's Law says that everything that can go wrong will go wrong. But Gerby's Law is everything that can go wrong can also go right. Isn't that right, Carrie?
It's very true, especially here on this show.
That's right. We are looking at things from the positive perspectives, and I want to say something very positive. Last week, I almost got all of the predictions for the Academy Awards that we did on the show correct.
I did too. I was very happy. I'm so happy Eddie Redmayne won. I can't even tell you.
Well, we both had Eddie Redmayne, but the difference was that Carrie picked Birdman, and I picked Boyhood. So there you go.
And you know what I did at my Academy Award party?
What did you do, Carrie?
Switched it to Boyhood.
No way.
I would have won the jackpot if I would have kept with Birdman.
Why didn't you keep with Birdman?
I don't know, and I kicked myself because I know I said it before, Birdman was going to win it, I switched it.
Carrie, you are just like all the judges that I appear before in court because when they hear me say something, they are convinced and they change their mind.
That's exactly what happened. I'm like, you know, Alan might be right.
I switched it
and I lost.
Well, there's always next year. So what did you think of NPH, my old friend?
I thought he was great.
Well, not everyone thought he was great. There were a couple jokes. You don't even know who it is.
Who's our last guest? I'm like, no, Larry. Larry was our last guest. I'm like, no. Wait, that's not NPH. I'm like, hold on.
You remind me of when Jimmy Kimmel does that spot on the street and they say, oh, wasn't that Birdman great? You know, I've never seen a man actually dressed in a bird costume the whole movie. And the person on the street says, yes, I thought that was incredible that he was able to stay in that costume and not
sweat
it.
They just go with whatever he says.
Right.
So I'm thinking, is it the last guest? And I'm like, yeah, I liked him. I remember
for
that.
For those of you not in the know, NPH is Neil Patrick Harris, my old friend. So now Carrie knows
now
what
I
to
know
call him.
Yes.
And she said he was great, but a lot of people said there were mixed reviews because some of his jokes fell flat.
Some of them did, but come on. To keep a show going entirely, I thought the opening was fabulous, of course. I thought the funny joke where he ran out in his underwear and did the whole Birdman thing was funny.
A lot of people thought it was in poor taste.
Oh, I thought it was very funny. I liked it. Now, Ellen DeGeneres last year had pizza coming to everybody. This is, to me, that brought the show down.
It's a very difficult thing, and
yes.
I know from good sources, my friend NPH will probably not do the Academy Awards again.
Probably not, because of all the reviews I read,
he has taken himself out of it. He lives on the East Coast for most of the time, and he's got his two kids, with David, his partner husband, and they don't want to disrupt their lifestyles to come back to Hollywood and do the Academy Awards again. That may be a cop-out, but I don't know. Let's talk a little bit about magic, because Ed Alonso, who is NPH's BFF. Do you know what a BFF is, Karen?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Best friends forever.
Correct. And he's a magician, and they put together this little magic thing for the Academy Awards, and I'm here right now I'm going to reveal magic's greatest secrets.
Well, that's what that guy on Fox did, and everybody hated
him. That's right. Valentino was his name,
right.
And he took off the mask, and a lot of magicians didn't like what he did. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about at the end when, you know, NPH put a lot into this briefcase thing where
Neil
he had his
Patrick
predictions.
Harris, just in case, NPH, you're going to call him that. Nobody knows who NPH is.
Okay, Neil Patrick Harris. And it went through the whole show, and then at one point he took it out, took the little card out, and it had all the predictions and everything was right.
Right.
How do they do that, Carrie?
Well, there's commercial breaks. I just believe.
No.
Yeah.
We had the woman who we couldn't pronounce his
Octavia
name.
Octavia Spencer was
watching
it.
And the only time she left was, you know, when she went.
I don't for one second that he predicted that.
Oh,
so,
come on.
Not
he
at
did.
All. No.
You know, especially to the point of, you know, John Travolta touching the cheek of
Idina Menzel.
Ira Manella.
Yeah, should we say Adele Nazim?
Well, I just said a law firm here in town, Irel and Manella. But anyway, here's the thing. What they do is it's called a quick switch. In the back, they're typing out and they're putting together that little card that he pulls out of it. And if you look carefully, and for those of you who have TiVo'd the Academy Awards, go back and watch the TiVo. He turns the briefcase just for a second and he replaces. He has the card that someone had handed to him and he brings it out. So it's never, the card that he reads was never in the briefcase in the first place.
Right.
So that's a little magic. And I'll tell you something. We are going to talk a little more magic today because we have someone on the show who actually represented David Copperfield.
That's pretty huge.
Well, not really. David Copperfield is nothing.
I love David Copperfield. I love magic. I took a magic class as an elective in seventh grade, and I got to go to the Magic Castle. And I've learned tricks that magicians now ask me for. That's how good my magic class was.
So, Carrie, we are so honored today. We are having one of the top 10 famous defense attorneys on the show today. Her name, of course, is none other than Ann Bremner, who has been involved in almost every case, whether as a legal commentator or actually defending someone in the case that you can think of. And she is on this list from the Criminal Justice Degrees Guide with people like the late Johnny Cochran, Mark Garagos, Alan Dershowitz, and, of course, Gloria Allred, who we had on the show not too long ago, Leslie Abramson, and number six, Ann Bremner. What a group of lawyers to be involved with. F. Lee Bailey's number seven, Sean Holly Chapman, and the list goes on. So we are thrilled to have Ann with us. We have so much to ask her, and we can even ask her about illusionist David Copperfield. What I like about Ann from the start, without ever speaking to her, is the fact that she says, and I quote, "I see legal commentary as valuable in educating the public." Doesn't that say it all?
That says, I think that's right on her Facebook. Yeah. Absolutely.
Of course it's on her Facebook.
Right there on her
Facebook. Didn't make it up.
No, I'm just saying, when I went to her Facebook, that's the first thing I saw, and it's a great quote. I was going to actually use it.
You were. Okay, so we're going to talk to Ann about a number of cases from the past and the present. We're going to talk about Aaron Hernandez case. We're going to talk about an Ellen Powell case. If you don't know about that case, you need to hear about it. There's also a case up in Washington where Ann is in Seattle, in Pasco, Washington. We're going to talk about that along with Amanda Knox and a number of other cases that you do not want to miss. So when we come back, we'll have none other than Ann Bremner right here on Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Stay tuned and join us after the break.
Any person who makes or causes to be made any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie & Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled.
disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gerby, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gerby, and Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gerby, and Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
Facebook goes by an authentic name policy, and if they believe that name is not authentic, then they will shut down your page and say, we will put it back up if you provide social security card. Really? A credit card? I don't think so. A piece of mail? Absolutely not.
Judge Christina live at 9.
Weekdays 9 to noon on 790 KABC.
Talk Radio 790 KABC, LA's first talk radio, on the air, online, and on iHeartRadio.
Talk Radio 790
KABC.
Welcome back to Gerby's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, indeed. That is right, turning Murphy's Law upside down. So, Carrie Kasem.
Yes, Alan Gerby.
Did you have pancakes today?
I don't eat pancakes.
Do you know that it's National Pancake Day today?
Is it? You know, there are gluten-free pancakes now, so I guess I could have one.
You could, and today would be the day. Erica Wise, one of our producers, told me that she woke up this morning wanting pancakes. And she didn't even know why, and then she realized it was National Pancake Day.
It must have been there. You must have heard it somewhere, Erica, and it just subconsciously.
And, Carrie, you know I'm a nonconformist. So what did I have this morning?
Bacon and eggs?
No. I don't eat bacon.
Good.
French toast.
It's kind of like pancakes.
No, it isn't.
Kind of a little bit.
No.
Still flour and eggs.
Well, yeah. I just want to tell you, we have on the line with us Ann Bremner, and she is attorney extraordinaire and, of course, a legal analyst that has been on every possible media outlet out there, and we're privileged to have her on the show with us. You're listening to Gerby's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Ann, welcome to Gerby's Law.
Oh, I'm so honored and thrilled to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and I want to tell you one thing right off the top. I want to spend a week in Hawaii with you.
Because in Hawaii?
In Hawaii. I got to tell you, it's so relaxing in Hawaii, and if I could just sit with you, and I bring my family along, of course, but if I could just sit with you and talk about all of these stories over your career up to the present time, I would be one happy camper, just with a Mai Tai.
I'd be happy, too. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Am I included in any of this? Any of this? No?
Sure.
It's
why not? Why not?
Me?
I just want to hear the fascinating stories that Ann has from all of these cases that she's been involved with, whether as a media analyst or as a defense attorney, trial attorney. And, you know, it would be incredible.
I have a question for you. Since you're in Washington, and my father died in Gig Harbor, and we were all over King County and all this, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Washington. Did you ever comment on my father being Casey Kasem, what was going on with him up in Washington?
Oh, I never, you know, I don't think I ever did, and someone just shared another article with me. What a tragedy. I'm so sorry for what happened and for your loss. There was just a new one that came out yesterday.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
I can send it to
Breaking
you.
News.
I followed
really?
Your dad's case so closely.
Now, and are you sure you're not confusing it with the NCI that was on Wednesday that they took off?
No, SVU. SVU.
Whatever it is.
Law and Order SVU. They actually, I couldn't believe it, ripped out of the headlines. Yeah, and they ripped the story out of the headlines. There was so much that was exactly like my case, and then there was a whole bunch that was not. But it was, when it was right, it was dead on.
Yeah, last weekend we spoke about stories that are factually based, that are translated in TV, and whether Creative License has any part of this, and of course it does. But I don't want to talk about that. Right now I want to get to you, because I don't have the week in Hawaii, unfortunately, so I have this time with us now. I want to go back in your career. You started off college at Stanford, then you went to Seattle University, and you were back then, like a liberal, idealist, Democrat, and then the first thing you do from 1983 to 88, you're a deputy prosecutor at King County Prosecution Office. How does that happen?
You know, I don't know. I clerked for a really wonderful judge, and he'd been a prosecutor, and he had tried a lot of cases, and he's a trial judge, and he really got me interested in being a prosecutor. I mean, he was the smartest judge in King County, the best, just fantastic, and so it kind of made a career change for me, like right from the very beginning, and all of a sudden, I was a DA, trying murder cases and rape cases and everything else, and it really was rewarding to be a prosecutor because you were helping victims.
Now, did that affect your outlook of how you saw these cases? Because I really believe that you understand evidence probably better than any other attorney around, whether it's circumstantial evidence, direct evidence, DNA evidence. Did that impact your ability to see how to actually prosecute a case and convict someone?
Well, absolutely, and thank you for that. You know, everything that I talk about on the air with cases that I cover nationally and locally, I learned it in the prosecutor's office a long time ago. I mean, and I was only there 5 years. But, you know, we were trained so well. I went to the National College of District Attorneys. My office sent me in Houston, and then I just learned so much about, just we used to say, watch one, do one, teach one. You know, that's how we learn how to try cases. You know, you watch one, then you try one, then you teach someone else how to do it.
That makes
so
a lot of sense.
Fantastic experience.
I said that makes a lot of sense because we are now looking at so many cases in the news over the last few years. We can talk about Ferguson. We can talk about the Eric Garner case in Staten Island and some of the other police brutality type cases. And what I want to know from you is, how do you defend the police behavior on some of these cases, and how do you differentiate where they shouldn't be defended and when they should?
Boy, that's a great question. I defend police officers. I have, you know, for decades in Seattle in different departments,
right,
mostly Seattle police. And so, I come from the perspective of the officer. You don't look at these things. The Supreme Court has said you don't look at use of force with 20/20 hindsight. You look from the perspective of the officer when things are unfolding so quickly. And I think then when we looked at the Ferguson case, we sure learned a lot about it at the end of the day. We had a lot of people talking about it, but we didn't know the facts until, you know, after the grand jury had rendered their decision. And, you know, and likewise in New York, you know, we've got the whole issue of chokeholds, but then again, he didn't die right away, the deceased.
Right.
He died sometime later. So you have to kind of sit back, really look at the facts, and make a decision, you know, with that, when you look at whether or not the force is objectively reasonable. And that's a tough call.
And let's talk about it. I'm sorry, Ann. Let's talk about Eric Garner, because you just mentioned about the chokehold. Now, he had some pre-existing medical conditions that may have actually aggravated and hastened his death because
right.
of what occurred. So do you look at that? Because I know you've made comments in the past that people have to look at themselves. You can't just look at the police in a vacuum and what they do.
Yeah, I mean, this is a situation where you have, and this is something I've seen in my own police cases, where you have medical conditions, asthma, diabetes, obesity, you know, and heart disease, you know, and then someone comes in contact with the police. So then you have, you know, death that may result from a variety of factors. I even had one case where somebody, you know, could have died within days just by virtue of being alive, and that's what the coroner had said. You know, and he died from involving police restraint. I mean, they're very difficult cases. There's also, you know, cases involving, you know, excited delirium that can be involved with, you know, use of even small amounts of cocaine and other amphetamines. So these cases are just more complicated than they appear to be at first blush. And it's really rare that you have an officer that goes out and wants to really take somebody out for no reason. I mean, and that's the other side of it. You know, you can't just look at police officers and say, you know, what they did was just horrific and they're a terrible person. You really need to look at each and every case. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just saying each case has to be decided on its own merits, not by virtue of whether you like or dislike police officers.
Now, have you ever defended somebody, and in the middle of defending them, you realize, you know what, this person's not telling me the truth, or, ooh, you know what, I found something I don't like, and at that point, I guess you have to keep defending them, but what do you do when that happens, and has it happened?
You know, I've never had it happen in an actual trial, but I've had it happen like it's happened to all of us before a trial. And when that happens, you know, sometimes I had a case where I had to go tell the other side, you know, that there'd been, there was an issue with some reports. And I had to go try that case ultimately, knowing that there was some dishonesty, and the jury knew it too. But we won. the case.
Perhaps you can work that into your case. Isn't that right?
I'm sorry, what?
Perhaps you can just work it into your case. I know as a trial lawyer myself, a lot of times I take the negatives that I have in my case and I explain it. And if you are upfront with it, a lot of times juries and judges will buy it and say, okay, let's get off of that issue and let's move on the next.
That's exactly right. And of course, in keeping with the theme of your show, which I love, but that's true. I mean, if you just look at them and you say, you know what, this was false, you know, but it doesn't have anything to do with, you know, what's being claimed in this case. And just to put it out there, you know, and say what resulted from, you know, that having occurred and that there were definitely, you know, severe repercussions, just put it all out there. And the jury could see through the facts and make the right decision.
What problem did you have with the ACLU and the police dog biting suspects?
You know, I used that great quote from Snoopy. Yesterday I was a dog, today I'm a dog. Tomorrow I'll probably still be a dog. There's just a little hope for advancement, you know. They sued in a class action our police dogs and saying that they were an unlawful use of force. And it was a 7-week-long trial. And at the end of the trial, I'm not kidding, the jurors said that the plaintiffs were barking up the wrong tree. I'm not kidding.
Oh, wow.
That's great.
Wow.
You know, it was really about dogs. You know, they're not really a use of force. I mean, they're basically a finding tool. And I mean, they can be used as a use of force, but they're not used as deadly force, I should say. And that's what the allegation was.
But let me just play devil's advocate for a second. I'm going to represent the ACLU right here and say the victims didn't have an opportunity to actually present their case. The Miranda rights or whatever you want to talk about, when a dog comes and bites them, the dog doesn't have the same thinking ability, the comprehension ability that the police officer has, and therefore their rights, the victim's rights, have been violated.
Well, the dog really acts at the behest of the handler.
Yes.
And so it is as if the handler, you know, is acting themselves, but they use the dog as a tool.
There you go.
And what the ACLU had claimed was they weren't really challenging the use of dogs in general. They were saying under Tennessee versus Garner, a use of a dog is deadly force. You know, therefore, you can only use the dog in certain situations, you know, like fleeing felons that poses a danger to others if not apprehended, or the officer, et cetera. So that was their analysis.
Yeah.
But I haven't heard one, I haven't heard one report, I mean, maybe I'm lost, but ever, where a police dog killed somebody.
Exactly. And there were one or two cases, but they're so rare. These were like anecdotal even. I mean, you're exactly right.
And?
The name of the case was Chew versus Gates, of all things. I mean,
Chew?
That I remember. It's been a long time since I tried that case.
Boy, you sound like Joan Rivers here with all these puns.
And the thing about the dogs is, you know, that they're very well trained. They're really good dogs. You know, they're trained in basically kind of a play mode, you know, reward mode.
Right.
And so in our dog's teeth, Lisa and I had this case recently filed by some Hollywood tooth artist or something. But, you know, they were really great dogs. And we brought the dogs into court. We brought in one dog, and he sat in front of the jury. And he actually scratched some fleas and then leaned up against my co-counsel in opening statement. So it was really about, you know, what do these dogs do? And, you know, what a great tool. And one of the things we'd always say is, you know, bites or bullets. I mean, do you want to use a dog or do you want to use a gun? I mean, the use of a dog, it's a great tool. They use their nose, they find people, and they help the police.
All right, enough about the poop case. Let's get on to some more serious stuff here.
More dogs.
I hear Benjamin Crump is coming to town in Pasco, Washington, for this crazy murder of Antonio Zambrano Montes.
You know, they're calling that the Washington State's Ferguson, and Benjamin Crum, of course, who represented Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin's family, he's now become involved with the family of the student. They haven't had an inquest yet. They're still investigating. They have an SIU formed of various police departments over there in the Tri-Cities looking into the case. It's on video. I'm sure you've seen it.
And yeah, I have. And we have to take a break, quick break for the news right now. Stay with us, and I'm going to pick this up after the break because I want to talk a little more about this case and talk about the Mexican Americans versus African Americans and whether that makes a difference in the media. You are listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. This is Alan Gervie with Carrie Casey. We're talking to Ann Bremner. We'll be right back.
The winner of the 2015 CPAC straw poll has just been revealed.
The winner of the CPAC 2015 presidential straw poll is Rand Paul.
CPAC being held in Maryland. As the search continues for those responsible for gunning down an outspoken critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin, correspondent Fred Plainton is in Moscow and says authorities believe the killing of Boris Nemtsov was very precise.
They believe that this was a professionally organized killing that took place. Nemtsov, of course, was supposed to be one of the people leading a rally here in the city of Moscow on Sunday. Originally, it was supposed to protest against Russia's policies in Ukraine, but now that rally after his death is going to turn into one of mourning for a man who died here on Friday night.
The Department of Homeland Security up and running for another week thanks to a stopgap funding bill. President Obama signed it last night. I'm Molly Page.
Private mortgage insurance, or PMI, can cost you thousands. But with the PMI advantage from Quicken Loans, you may never have to pay those expensive monthly mortgage insurance premiums again. Hi, I'm Jay Farner, president of Quicken Loans, and I'm excited to tell you that the Quicken Loans PMI advantage is our lender-paid mortgage insurance program. You see, we pay the PMI so you don't have to. Make the smart call and talk to one of our home loan experts today at 800-QUICKEN. You'll learn how the Quicken Loans PMI Advantage can give you more options, more flexibility, and may save you thousands when you refinance. And for 5 years in a row now, J.D. Power has ranked Quicken Loans highest in the nation in customer satisfaction. And this year, for the first time, they've also ranked us highest in mortgage servicing. To learn more, call us at 800-QUICKEN. That's 800-QUICKEN, or visit us at quickenloans.com.
Visit jdpower.com for award information. Important terms and conditions apply. Call us for cost information. Equal housing lender. License law 50 states and home loss number 3030.
Contractors, Steve Swartz here again from South Coast Surety. As you know, bidding season is right now. Jobs are coming up that you want to get on. I know you're probably doing an awful lot of private jobs or looking at the private jobs, but there's public works on the horizon. You want to take advantage of the opportunities. And that's where South Coast Surety comes in. We make it easy for you to get your bond support. Do you already have surety? Do you want to make sure that you have the best support you can get, the best rate you can get, the best limits you can get? Or you haven't been bonded before, you haven't done bonded work, and even private jobs now are requiring bonds. South Coast Surety can make it happen. South Coast Surety is the leader in getting you surety support. We sure make it easy to get the jobs you want, and we sure make it easy to get the bonds to cover them. 1-800-361-1720. That's 1-800-361-1720. Or check us out, South Coast Surety. That's SURETY.com.
I'm Little Teapot, short and stout.
Here is my handle and here is my spout.
Now that, like this. When I get all steamed up, then I shout, tip me over and
pull me out.
This is WWE superstar Roman Reigns. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today.
Visit fatherhood.gov, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Millennials don't want to run for office.
And scientists create music for cats on the next Doug and T-Ray live at Local 5 tonight right here on the radio, home of the Stanley Cup champ LA Kings. Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Get news, weather, sports, markets, and traffic first on the Fords.
Come on, let's hit the road!
Only here.
KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah. You are listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC, and we are speaking with none other than Ann Bremner, who's one of the top trial attorneys in the country. And if you want to take a look at her, you go to AnnBremner.com, AnnBremner.com, or go to her Facebook page, and you will be shocked at how such a brilliant woman can look so beautiful. She's also at Ann Bremner for Twitter purposes, tweeting at Ann Bremner. Ann M. Bremner. And we were talking about the Pascoe, Washington case before we went off the air for the news. And I want to pick that up because Ferguson became such a huge deal, and it was mostly because at that time the African Americans were seeing it as a racial thing. Do we see Pasco, Washington as a racial thing against Mexican Americans?
The lawyer that has just been retained by the family, at least in the headline, there was a statement attributed to him that he did not see this as racial. This is a case of a decedent who's from Mexico and is living in Pasco, Washington, was living in Pasco, has two children, as I understand it, and a wife. But it's not clear to me. You know, we've had protests daily in Pasco. I think there have been issues of race raised, and it's been compared to the Ferguson case, although the only difference a lot of people have seen is that this case is on videotape, and the Ferguson case, of course, wasn't.
Do you think that he was shot twice in the back, as his family and the attorney for his family has stated?
You know, there's been two autopsies. There's been, of course, the one from the county or the city medical examiner, and then there's been a quote-unquote independent autopsy. That latter autopsy is the one that there's a claim that there's been two shots in the back. You know, I don't know. I haven't read both reports. You know, I haven't seen, you know, the photographs or seen the trajectories of the bullets, et cetera. But that is from an independent autopsy that's out there right now.
In Washington, do you have the stand your ground law?
We do, but ours is not by statute. Ours is under the common law, and it's used in police cases all the time, in a jury instruction that basically says, if you're in a place you have a right to be, you have a right to, and you're threatened with deadly force, you have a right to stand your ground and use force. And it's used in police cases, that instruction, based on stand your ground common law.
But this guy, I have to say, he was throwing rocks at them. I mean, that's not enough, I don't think, to be shot. But he's throwing rocks at them. He won't stop. He's now shot with a stun gun twice. He's still not stopping. Who knows if the guy has a gun? If I was an officer and this guy, obviously, I don't know if he was on drugs. I don't know what's going on. But who knows if he reaches around, pulls a gun out, and you're dead. You know, I don't understand this. This is, there's policemen. They have guns. They're going to shoot you if you attack them. So what's in his head?
Right, and that's an excellent point. And you know, importantly, three officers presumably felt threatened enough to shoot. All three.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a case where one did and the others didn't. I mean, they have to look at that circumstance as well when you look at what you just described. And, you know, what people don't understand is, I'm on call. I have been for years. I'm not doing it now, but I've been on call for police shootings for years in the middle of the night, you know, 3 in the morning. But I go out to the scene and talk to a police officer when they've been involved in a fatality. And you know, and then I'll say it happened so fast, you know. I didn't want to do it. You know, he made me do it. You know, those are the kinds of things that you hear, and they're very emotional about it. I mean, obviously, they feel horrific that a life was taken. But those are the kinds of things they say.
Well, we'll wait around and see what happens and how much media attention comes out to Pasco, Washington on this case, because it's unfolding as we speak. I'm going to change gears just a little bit because you said in these cases it happens so quickly, but there's a case where you defended a police department and things didn't happen quickly, and I'm talking about the Des Moines Police Department and the Vili Fualo civil suit, and that, of course, is, everyone will remember, the Mary Kay Letourneau rape trial, and this is the civil suit where you defended the Des Moines Police Department, and there's some real positives that I believe come out of it because you said some things in that situation which really defended the police department and maybe pointed the finger at the mother of Vili or himself, and I think her name was Vili too, wasn't it?
The mother was Suna.
Suna, right. So that was something where you prevailed, and tell us a little bit about the theory, and you know, I know you've been quoted as saying it was just to make money, that's why they filed the civil case, but there's a moral underpinning which is really intriguing to me when you're taking negatives and turning them into positives.
Well, in that case, I was defending the police because it was alleged they failed to protect Mary, or excuse me, Billy from Mary.
Right.
And the school district was, of course, its co-defendant. And so, you know, I had a number of things, you know, one of which was nothing to keep them apart. And I argued that, they would get married. And that no matter what, you know, no matter what we would have done or anyone would have done, they would always be together. And guess what? They still are, you know, even after 7 years in prison. You know, she got out, they got married. So that was one of their themes, you know. But another one, there was a Hollywood agent that said, if you squint your eyes, it all makes sense. And so I argued to the jury, I mean, maybe this isn't the most traditional love story, but there's a relationship there, you know, there's a future there. And it's something that is not, you know, the damaging thing that was alleged by the plaintiff's lawyer. So that was another one. And then finally, you know, hindsight's 20/20, who would have thought that Mary Taylor Turner, this gorgeous, you know, teacher, would be involved with a sixth grader, you know, who was 12? You know, I mean, you can look back, it's a case that shocked the world. So why would the police have known that she would be involved with a 12-year-old kid? And then finally, it was about the money, money, and more money. There was a lot of tabloid money that went out to Sina, but not to Billy or Mary. But once that money was gone, that's when the lawsuit got filed.
But don't you think, Anne, that on a lot of these cases, and I'm not going to make a comment on Ferguson or Eric Garner or any of these other cases, but don't you think people have to take responsibility themselves and
yes.
perhaps parents, and if you're an adult, to take responsibility? It seems in this country that we always want to point the finger at others and blame others when we should really be taking responsibility ourselves and looking at ourselves, looking into what are our motivations and what our parents are, and be more protective of ourselves rather than making it just, you know, always about someone else.
Well, exactly. In the Mary Kay Letourneau case, you know, and she and I have remained friends all these years later, but, you know, the mother of Billy wanted them together. I mean, and then the mother of Billy was out talking to television and other reporters at times for money, saying that it's a love story. It's not a crime story, you know, that they really want to be together. And that was something that reaped a lot of, you know, rewards. And then we end up, you know, with this case. But at the end of the day, you know, Billy and Mary are married with two kids. She's a paralegal. You know, he's a DJ in Seattle. And you know, they're living, presumably, you know, happily ever after. But they didn't need to go through that long, I think it was an 11-week long trial.
Right.
Did Mary Kay ever say to you, you know, look, I know this is odd. I wouldn't have gone after a 12-year-old. That's not my motive. I wasn't attracted to 12-year-old boys. He didn't look 12. Did she know it was wrong in that sense? Let's take the feelings away.
Well, he was actually 13 when they became involved, and he had a mustache. I mean, he'd already been involved sexually, I mean, at least to some extent before that. Did she know it was wrong? She knew morally it was wrong. She knew it was wrong, but she was a teacher. You know, but, you know, he was kind of an old soul. You know, he was somebody that was far older than his years. He'd come from an abusive family. His dad was in prison. You know, I could go on and on, but they seemed to have a connection. Sure, she knew it was wrong, but she didn't know it was criminal, and she went to prison for 7 years.
And my first boyfriend slept with his teacher at 12, and for him, that was, I mean, he could tell his friends, and that was a big thing, and it was so cool. And he, I mean, it didn't. I don't know. I could be wrong, but to him, it was like, yeah, that was wow. I won the biggest prize. I got the teacher.
You know, Carrie, Anne, I want you to answer this, but I'm going to make it a little more tough for you because Carrie just gave that comment. I want to quote you, and then I want you to respond to Carrie's question. And your quote is, nothing could have kept the two of them apart. And the question that I have, playing devil's advocate here, is when someone's 12 or 13, I don't care how they look, whether they have a mustache, whether they're, you know, mature beyond their years, how could you conclude that nothing could have kept them apart? Because if you can do that, I want you to come and hang out with some of my friends and just tell them whether they're going to stay together with their boyfriends or girlfriends or not.
Well, it was really a proximate cause argument. You know, I mean, it was more of a legal argument, which is, you know, they'd better show that if the police had intervened, you know, that this wouldn't have happened. You know, that they wouldn't have had two kids. You know, they wouldn't have had sex and all that kind of thing. And our view was, you know, she was writing to him from prison. She had got no good time because, you know, she served her full term because she couldn't stop contacting him and writing to him and, you know, getting to him directly and getting back together with him when she got out. When she was out on kind of a pretrial kind of probation, I guess we can call it, on a sexual assault alternative sentence, that's how they got together again, and they had another baby. So that's kind of the argument. You know, it's just not condoning, you know, that relationship. It's just the fact is that's what it is. And there were all those, you know, summer 42 references, you know, that she was every schoolboy's dream, you know, Mrs. Robinson, you know, et cetera. And he was bragging to his friends. He bragged to his friends. He bet $20 that he'd have sex with Mary Kay Letourneau.
Wow. You know, we have to take a quick break. Can you stay with us for one more second? Because I got a couple more cases I want to talk about. Yeah, so we're going to talk about that Amanda Knox. We're going to talk about Aaron Hernandez and Ellen Powell when we get back. So we're going to have 15 minutes. We're going to have to really get through these cases because it's really important that while we have you here. And stay with us. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Any person who makes a cause to be made, any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
Seen some of these names on Facebook? Funky Mushroom, Anonymous Ninja, I Love Cupcakes, versus Shane Creeping Bear, Dana Lone Hill, Lala Lakota Lance Brown Eyes. The difference? Those last three names are being banned in question as an authentic name on Facebook. Facebook goes by an authentic name policy, and if they believe that name is not authentic, then they will shut down your page and say, we will put it back up if you provide Social Security card. Really? A credit card? I don't think so. A piece of mail? Absolutely not.
Judge Christina Live at 9.
Weekdays 9 to noon on 790 KABC.
Get from point A to point B without the frustration.
Get off the road, you freaking maniac!
Traffic first on the fours. Only here.
KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
And that's right. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. I am Alan Gervie, and we are talking with Ann Bremner. I'm here with Carrie Kasem, and I'm going to shift gears really quickly, and we appreciate you staying on. Ann is, of course, at AnnBremner.com. That's B-R-E-M-N-E-R.com. And we're going to talk real quickly about Aaron Hernandez. Of course, Aaron Hernandez was tight end for the New England Patriots, and he is on trial right now for the murder of Odin Lloyd. Now, you were quoted as saying in the Aaron Hernandez case that the prosecution is presenting strong circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence is as valid as direct evidence. Can you comment on that?
Yes. You know when people say, oh, it's just a circumstantial
case? Right.
Well, circumstantial evidence under the law is given equal weight to direct evidence, as you know.
Yeah.
So I always say, you know, witnesses can and do lie, they can be mistaken, but the evidence never lies. And that's why I like circumstantial evidence better, because it's evidence. It just speaks for itself. And so I think a strong circumstantial case is the best kind of case to have as a prosecutor, and that's what they have here in Aaron Hernandez.
And a lot of things have been going on in the trial. You know, they can't find his shoes, and they expected if they found his shoes that perhaps, you know, they could tie it to the murder scene. He apparently, in his man cave, cut off his camera so you couldn't see what was going on there. And then, of course, there was the video of him taking his cell phone apart when he had been charged. So is that considered circumstantial evidence?
Yes. And also consciousness of guilt, you know, all the after-the-fact activities, you know, that he underwent, you know, why? Because he tried to cover up, presumably, that he was involved in a murder. And then you've got also the circumstantial evidence of, you know, the phone records that came in yesterday, you know, the texting,
right,
the triangulation with the cell phone towers. on in everything else. You've got him on video, you know, at that convenience store and dancing in front of his car. You've got him, you know, you've got this friend that testifies that there was a group together, you know, up until about midnight. And then of course, you've got things like the shell casing in the car matching a Glock. You know, you've got the fingerprints of the victim in the rental car. You know, all of those things, the dirt that matches the dirt under the body in the rental car. And, of course, the shoe prints, the tire prints, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those are all excellent items of circumstantial evidence.
And you just gave the closing argument for the prosecution. And I am going to rule on this. Guilty.
Okay, what's your ruling?
Guilty, guilty. Yeah. I'm telling you, that circumstantial evidence adds up.
It does. It really does. And it's one of my the most interesting cases I've covered because there's just so much of it.
Yeah, I
agree. And a lot of it he created himself.
I agree. I think that, unfortunately, Aaron is done, but probably fortunately for all of us, that he is out of the public from what he did. And, of course, we've got a couple of other murder charges against him in the background. Let's talk about Amanda Knox really quickly because she's in Seattle and you've had a lot of involvement in her case through the years. And I guess the question is that everyone wants to know, will they ever get her back to Italy in order to proceed after the Supreme Court in Italy makes a ruling?
You know, hopefully not. She's often considered to us Seattleites as, you know, an innocent abroad. And she, you know, the decision of the Supreme Court is expected shortly. On her conviction is conditional.
Right.
The Supreme Court would have to make affirm it, you know, for it to be a conviction. You know, if that happens, God forbid, then there could be extradition proceedings started, and it would be before a federal judge out here in Seattle. But I think that she's got excellent defenses on extradition, including, even though it's not in the treaty, in double jeopardy. You know, this is triple jeopardy right now that she's faced in Italy. And then, of course, the treaty talks about factual innocence, and, of course, that's present here, too.
But Anne, doesn't that presuppose that the courts in Washington and in the United States are going to have to really look at the evidence from the underlying trial, which is not really what the issue is with the extradition?
Yeah, they're going to have to look at some evidence. I mean, the Italian government's going to have to produce evidence that she was involved at the extradition, and I don't know what form that's going to take. But, you know, there's been three trials, and don't forget that on the appeal, which was de novo, you know,
right.
There's the appointment of an independent panel of experts on the forensics, and that panel, appointed by the judge, said that the evidence was inadmissible, it was compromised, and it was not in any way reliable.
And what about the real killer, Rudy? He's going to be out.
Yeah, every time Rudy turns around, he gets a few more years shaved off.
Well, he better.
What's going on over there?
They better not let the guy out because
they might at this rate.
I mean, you know, they've been cutting his sentence, then keeping him in. But you know, if anyone really looks at the evidence, which I know you have, uh-huh. Isn't it clear that he acted solely in this murder?
Oh yeah, I mean his fingerprints. You know, his. You know, the blood, the DNA, the motive, the admissions, the flight. I mean, that's all there against Rudy Gaudet. That's why he did his full guilty plea.
Well, we commend you for helping out with Amanda Knox, and hopefully.
I have a question on that, because if she does get, like, they say they want her extradited, does she have any legal recourse here? Can she say, no, I'm an American citizen, we can't, there's no such thing as double, triple jeopardy, I'm not going back there?
Yes, I mean, but she's going to have to do it to the courts if the State Department decides to go forward with the extradition request and actually have an extradition hearing.
Okay, so but the State Department could say refuse to send her back.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
They could, but
yes, exactly.
It does become a political issue because, you know, you're supposed to respect other countries' rule
right.
of law. So
that's right. It's the comedy of nations, C-O-M-I-T-Y, not to be confused with comedy.
Right. No comedy.
Right. I mean, if you don't have a treaty, then you rely on comedy of nations, but comedy of nations carries the day. I mean, we have to have
absolutely.
Good international relations with Italy.
And that's what the real conflict is. And, you know, I don't know where it's going to turn out, but I am pulling, obviously, for Amanda. Finally, we want to talk about the Ellen Powell case versus the venture capital firm. A lot of people haven't heard about that, and it's probably an hour in and of itself. But it involves gender discrimination. Tell us a little bit about...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part. About which case?
The Ellen Powell case and the Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers. Ellen was the person who you've commented on this, I believe. She went to Princeton and Harvard. The Asian woman.
Oh yeah, okay, woman. I just didn't hear the first part. That's a fascinating case in San Francisco, and she has a degree from Princeton undergrad. She has a law degree and an MBA from Harvard. And in the company, you know, that she's filed the lawsuit against, she was asked to take notes from the men that were sitting in a private plane. I think they were talking some sex talk, too, at the time.
Yes.
You know, that there was allegations that someone's showing up in their, just their bathrobe.
Right at her door on a business trip.
Right, on a business trip. And things like, you know, basically saying that women kill the buzz. So the men would all meet with other women, including Al Gore's, who's a partner there, condo, in the building where she lived. And it was all men. You know, it's one of these, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same kind of allegations, is that, you know, here's this highly educated woman who, by the way, now is the interim CEO at Reddit, yeah. You know, was treated in that fashion. And it's really surprising.
Well, you know, there's other women coming out saying that they were treated that same way and that,
right.
that there was, you know, sexual harassment or harassment. It happened to them as well. And since she's the one who spoke up about it, she's now not, you know,
right. They're
making her pay for it.
Retaliation.
Yeah.
She claimed the sexual discrimination. And they talked about promotions. Apparently three men were promoted prior to the three women, and they had started actually
later. Before
the men.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know where that's going to go. What is your prediction as to what's going to unfold in this San Francisco trial?
You know, I'm watching that one really closely. I think she's got a good case, you know, especially because one of the worst things you can do in an employment case is retaliate. You know, it's kind of like the cover-up. Sometimes it's worse than the crime.
That's
right. She filed a lawsuit, and then they fired her. So, I mean, it's like pretty black and white, you know.
Right, and, you know, I deal with that a lot in workers' compensation in California because people file claims. They legitimately get injured at work, and then before you know it, the employer just gets rid of them for no apparent reason. They try and trump up charges. And it becomes very difficult because you have to have some protections. And I agree with you on this one because I think that she can show that some of these guys were really operating outside the scope of the employment.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing case. And it's, you know, I guess to me it's like you wonder, you know, is this a good old boys club or is it a good young boys club? I mean, this is, you know, you're talking about the Silicon Valley, you know. Where you can have, you know, it's kind of geek central. You know, they do very, very well, but
yeah. It's
kind of a young person's, you know, business.
And I really believe they're socially inept, those geeks
who are running these companies.
You know, they don't know how. They spend so much time with their computers and everything.
Exactly.
They don't know how to deal with people, and especially men and women. And there is a dynamic in the workplace. I see it all the time where there has to be respect for both sides.
Yeah, it's just astonishing. I mean, I remember a judge asked me to babysit a defendant's kids in the hallway once, and I did it. You know, but I mean, that was on film.
you're the lead attorney in the trial, and you're babysitting the kids. You know,
exactly.
And it has been such a pleasure having you on Gervie's Law today. I hope you'll be able to come back and maybe talk about some of these cases as they fold out. Aaron Hernandez, Alan Powell case, and some of the others. We really appreciate all of your insight and comments.
No, it's been such a pleasure and such an honor. Thanks for having me.
Well, we wish you all the luck. Of course, she's at AnnBremner.com, AnnBremner.com, at Ann Bremner for her Twitter handle. She is amazing, and follow her and also listen to her commentary. Now, Carrie, this has been a full show. We have Ken Kokin here, and unfortunately,
yes, we
only have a minute left. Ken, what can you tell us in 1 minute?
Well, geez. Well, I'll just ask
a
question
that
will help the world. So, as the managing partner of my life, my question is, if you're in an airplane and you're on the aisle seat and somebody else is in the window seat and you want the window closed, who gets jurisdiction over the window?
Who gets jurisdiction over the window?
Yes,
I believe the person in the window seat.
That's right.
Because
it's shining into my eyes.
If it's shining into your, it's about moral. It's about doing the right thing. It's about taking negatives and turning them to positives. Do what's right. Shut that darn shade, even if it isn't something that you want. Try to be nice to people. Be kind. It'll all come back, and it'll make everything work
so
well.
So the moral of the story is you ask, and hopefully they put the window down.
And if they fail.
Thanks for listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.